This is a special session that was followed up on the Baton to March of Death. My name is Bill Mattson. I personally experienced the things that we are going to talk about. When I was teaching, I didn't like to be thought of one who just lectured to his students. I would prefer to be thought of as one who had controlled discussions, if there's that much difference between. And this is what I hope to do this evening. I have spoken on this subject quite a few times. If there were a series of meetings, then we could have organized something perhaps a little more formal. What I hope to do is first give you a short resume about my experiences or my travels, or call them what you like, between December 7th, 1941 and you might say September 15th, 1945. Before I start though, there are three things that and then we'll open it up to questions and answers, because I have found from previous experiences on this particular subject that there are some, that the questions that you ask will lead to many of the things that you want to know about. And in the shortness of time, it seemed to be the best method than for me to just talk on and on. In other words, what you ask me would be what it comes out. There are three things I would like to point out from the beginning. First of all, I do not consider myself a hero in any manner. I did what I thought was wanted of me. I joined to serve my country. Of course, I joined for a year, and it turned out to be quite some time. Secondly, I do not hold any animosity or ill feelings to our former enemies, in particularly in my case, the Japanese. It is perhaps true that if I was confronted with some individuals who personally that I knew performed the atrocities and the brutality and that, I imagine a few hackles would rise in my neck, because I am quite a hot-blooded Finn. Thirdly, I definitely feel that it was the grace of God that I survived. I also definitely feel that my survival was a learning process for me. And I definitely feel that having survived, I must have some message in life, some purpose there. I think all of us survivors feel that. Out of the Bataan veterans, there are approximately 2,000 living today out of the original 26,000 Americans. So we'll begin. When Pearl Harbor was hit, I was stationed with the 194th Tank Battalion in Fort Stotzenberg, Pampanga, Luzon, which is better known now as Clark Air Force Base. We were a National Guard outfit. My company was Brainerd, Minnesota. We had companies from St. Joe, Missouri, Salinas, California, Harrisburg, Kentucky. Quite often, on those first days of the war, we remembered the promise that President Roosevelt made when he mobilized the National Guard, and no National Guard would ever be sent overseas unless an extreme emergency or a war. And that was in 1940. Here we were. The Japs hit us, and please, I don't use the word Japs as derogatory and all that, except it's short for Japanese. But they hit us very strongly, thoroughly, at Clark Air Force Base. There are many unquestioned questions about the, and I have my theories, which are pretty well accepted now, not from me, but I mean from others, historians, on our involvement, and that's not the purpose of this meeting today. We fought then as best we could with the Filipinos. The Filipinos were very poorly trained, with the exception of the Philippine Scouts, which were a fine fighting unit. And we retreated, what we called a strategic retreat, into the peninsula of Bataan and on Corregidor. Corregidor and Bataan protects the approximately 50-mile diameter Manila Bay. And thus, by holding Corregidor and Bataan, we would deny the Japanese the use of Manila Bay and the city of Manila. The plan was good, but we were lacking supplies. One of the difficulties was that hordes and hordes of Philippine civilians poured across our lines into Bataan, as well as the military personnel. So we were feeding civilians as well as ourselves. And our supplies ran very low. And for 2 months before this Bataan surrendered, which was April 9th in 42, we had been living on two rations with approximately 1,000 calories a day for 2 months. You can see immediately that we weren't in very good shape for the death march there. As long as we kept the mountain heights, we managed to hold out, but without supplies and food and an air force to protect us, Bataan fell on April 9th, 1942. That was the beginning of the death march. On the death march were approximately 40,000 Filipino troops and 12,000 Americans. And they figured it, the march itself killed 4,000 or 5,000 Americans and upwards to 20,000-some Filipinos besides the civilians. This is why I believe it's Pastor Wick's class or seminar on death and dying, where I mentioned sometimes I feel that suffering is a learning process by the Lord. Or was it Susan's? I can't remember. I think it was her, because she misunderstood me. And the reason is that I saw all spectrum, the total spectrum of death, in all forms and all manners and so forth. We were taken then to the march. The march was 113 kilometers, approximately 72 miles. But it was under extreme conditions with no food and water, except what you could steal, the hottest time of the year, and under the conditions that the weather was. We marched then to San Fernando, Pampanga, and there we did get a ride, but what a ride. They had boxcars, narrow gauge railroad boxcars of steel, and they forced 150 men each into each one of those narrow gauge cars, slammed the doors shut, put us on a siding, and it's only 13 kilometers from San Fernando to Capiz, and we stayed all day in the hot sun in those steel cars. And we finally got to O'Donnell. He opened the doors, and a good portion of the men fell over dead. They couldn't even slump in their death. They had to stand. And we marched 13 kilometers remaining to the first prison camp. I still was blessed with, I don't know what, because I'm not the biggest person. In fact, I joined the Army, I weighed only 134 pounds. But I guess it's a Finnish sisu that I had, which is slang for stubbornness and courage. That I felt that I could better myself by going out and working. The Japanese did promise extra food if we would work. And I volunteered to go out with the Japanese Engineer Battalion building bridges that we had destroyed in the war. This was one of the few good details, if there's such a good detail in prison camp. It was a engineer battalion out of China. They respected a soldier for being a soldier. They fed us fairly well, and as long as we behaved ourselves, we got along. I feel that this was an act of God. However, unfortunately, on this work detail, I contacted malaria, dysentery, and other of these diseases, and finally had to go into the main prison camp at Cabana Tawan. There, dysentery and malaria took me so bad, and I could not get into the dysentery side of the hospital because I could not get a positive reaction to my stool exam. It was still registering negative with the poor microscopic conditions that they had. It seems strange that they didn't send me anyway because they knew what I had. You could tell from the results. When I went down, my buddies, the fellow I owe my life to, lives in San Diego now. I just saw him a week and a half ago at our reunion in Brainerd, Minnesota. There. He's one that I owe my life to. But he says, under 90 pounds in weight. To give you an idea of the conditions, I think many of us have seen pictures of the Holocaust and Dachau and Auschwitz, those places. We weren't any different. I could reach around my biceps and touch my hands like this. I could reach around my waist, touch my fingers. I told my wife, and she knows that the only time I ever gave up was my will to live was there, trying to get into the dysentery section of the hospital. John Faulkner from Brainerd, high school buddy, saw me, tried to force me to eat. He knew I had given up my will, but to no avail. To this day, I don't remember what he said. But he said something that triggered a angry reaction from me. As I said, I do have quite an explosive temper, and I got mad. And that just that getting mad started the adrenaline working again. And he had from somewhere he got an egg and a little bit of sugar and mixed in that lugao, which is a watered rice, similar to, much thinner than our oatmeal this morning, and mixed it together and spoon-fed me and got my will back to live. That is the only time that I... Yeah. If we got by a day without beatings we figured was a lucky day. I feel that in spite of the brutality, the malnutrition, the hardships, the most important thing was to keep your mind healthy. From prison camp, my faith became stronger as the days went by. It is when there that I realized that we are Christians, first of all. True, there was all kinds of horrible things that were going on, and there was stealing among the men, even some brutal things even among the men, because of their desire to. I worked on a farm detail and an airstrip, and then one day I came back from the airstrip. That was in late 43. And the Japanese, or the barrack sergeant said, well, the Japanese want 1,000 men for a foreign detail. Any volunteers? And I had never learned my lesson well. I raised my hand and volunteered again. I just felt I wanted to get out of there to a different situation. This John Faulkner, who I mentioned I owe my life to, and another friend, Frank South, were in the tailor shop in Cabana de Juan. Not that it was anything to brag about, but we did have sort of a tailor shop where people could try and mend their clothes and that. Frank South, out of our outfit, was a tailor. I also had we had an officer, Captain Quinlan, who was married to a cousin of mine, a second cousin. And they were very upset with me when I told them that I had volunteered to leave on a foreign detail. But there again, I think it's the Lord working in my behalf, because it turned out Frank was the only one who made it. Quinlan went down on a ship by our own submarines, and so did Frank South, because the Japanese took every able-bodied man, and what they mean by able-bodied man was anybody that was able to walk or hobble, to Japan. Many of the prisoners that were left in the Philippines were killed at the camps, such as the massacre at Palawan. So I feel there again, my path in life was already predestined for me. I went to Japan, and the past year and a half I worked in a Japanese coal mine, underground coal mine. How they decided whether you work bottom side or top side was your weight. And that's why I'm so weight conscious of what at my weight was at that time, because I hovered around 100 pounds. And if you were 100 pounds on over, you worked bottom side underground there with no mass or not. Part of my emphysema that I have is because of that. The other is my own carelessness of smoking and there. And when you worked less than, if weighed 100, less, but once a month or so forth, they weighed you. And if you weighed less than 100 pounds, then you worked topside there. It was that coal mine that I finally got out very hurriedly. The Navy took us out to Wakayama, and what a joyous day was that. I might say even now, I think you hear me sometimes when I speak, I choke up a little bit. I may have some tears in my eyes, but I'm not ashamed of it. But I remember very clearly that day when I stepped off, and that Navy nurse asked me how I felt. I cried. We all did. But But then we were overjoyed also. Taken on the hospital ship, the Navy doctor, I know, I stepped on a scale. I was stark naked. He asked me how I felt. I was overjoyed. And I told him, felt like $1 million. I don't think there was any bigger lie except over just motions. He said, well, son, he said, step on the scale. I stepped 103 pounds. We've been living on rations that have been dropped from planes for 2 weeks. So I must have been probably in the 90s at the end of the war, still working. He said, well, it's just in case. He said, we'll take you on the hospital ship Constellation, which incidentally now is the USS Hope, as a medical hospital that has the ship. I went down to the Philippines, spent 6 weeks there at Operation and 311 General Hospital, and then flown to the States. There again, our paths were planned. I went to McCoy Station Hospital in McCoy, Wisconsin. And that's where I met my wife, was my Army nurse, sitting back there. Even it was because of my stubbornness and unyielding nature that I got to meet her, because I got tossed out of a ward because of a dispute with an officer, a doctor, that kicked me out of that his ward and sent me over to where my wife was working. So everything is planned. All right, briefly then, that's a resume of my experiences. Now I would like to perhaps open it up to questions.
Bill, would you describe your trip on the love boat from the Philippines to Japan?
Yes, most of the ships are that way, and there again, I think we were lucky because we left Manila on a convoy and a few days out of Manila heading towards Formosa and then Japan, we hit a typhoon. Mm-hmm. We had some Japanese naval vessels with us, and a couple times we had submarine alerts, I imagine, because we started zigzagging and destroyers started circling and all that. But we hit this typhoon and Lord knows where we went. I think it blew us down around Singapore because it took us 32 days to get to Taipei or Takao, Formosa. I don't know what that meat figures out per day, but it's an old Canadian freighter called Canadian Venture. We call it the Mati Mati Maru. Mati is weight. In other words, it was so slow, it was pitiful, and we call it, hence the name. And then it took us another 30 days to go from Takao to Japan. But we made it. Many of the other ships didn't make it. Yes?
I understand you to say that the Navy ship came in and rescued you?
No, it was a Navy had the responsibility of getting us out of our prison camp in Japan, Wakayama, Japan. That was the end of the war.
Oh, the war was over.
Yeah, Wakayama. And Wakayama was the headquarters for the fleet headquarters. Incidentally, my prison camp in Japan was 80 kilometers from Hiroshima, where the A-bomb was dropped. We saw the mushroom cloud. Yes.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this because my kid brother was in this situation too, and he was in the prison camp, maybe the same one you were in. He had dysentery in the hospital. Evidently, got well enough that you mentioned the ship that was torpedoed. He was on that ship, and he lost his life that time. This whole thing is a little bit indistinct for me as far as the what happened. We got some news at that time, it's a long time ago now. He volunteered when he was a junior in college. He and his friend, and they were immediately shipped out to the Philippines. and he got involved in this. And I was wondering, can you draw us a rough map or showing just about where you were captured by the Japanese and where this march took place?
Very crudely, this is Luzon, the northernmost island, and perhaps I should very hurriedly say the Philippines is a very beautiful place, considered of 7,300 somewhat islands, and they have. Imagine ruling a country of that type, because there are 74 different ethnic tribes in the Philippines, 52 of them with their own language. And then you take into consideration the religious factor, mainly the Protestant or the Catholic and the Muslim, and then some Hindu and the Chinese, so you can see the complexity. Luzon here is Manila, Manila Bay, regular island there. This is Bataan Peninsula, here. Some of you, I've talked with a few of you here that came in on the invasion with the 6th Army in Lingayen. There it is, there. Some came in Bataan is down here, there. Marvelous Bataan is a tip. So some of the prisoners actually marched a lot further than others, up to San Fernando. Here we caught the train, went to 13 kilometers to Capas, up there. And then that was the first prison camp, O'Donnell. Cabana Duan is also in the Central Plains. Those are the two largest prison camps. However, they had other prison camps in the Visayan, the Middle Islands, and also down in Mindanao. Incidentally, Mindanao, some of you may know I do return, and my wife has returned with me on a couple times to the missions in the Philippines.
I thought there was torpedoes. Was that part of the convoy that you were?
No, and not that I know, because we lost our convoy, which I think was a blessing, and we made it on our own. But there were many ships that were sunk, either torpedoed by our submarines, and in fairness to our forces there, they took us in any available ship. They weren't marked in any manner. So our forces had no way of telling whether there were prisoners on board or not. Yes, some did make it. I tried to make it, but every available ship was taken. Some tried to swim it, which was impossible, floated across with logs, bunkas, which are native dugouts. So forth. Of course, Bataan or Corregidor only lasted another month barely, not quite. Corregidor fell on May 6th. There. Yes?
My brother-in-law was on the Bataan Death March, John Peterson from San Luis Obispo, and he stated the same thing that he had dysentery in the prison camp, and he could put his fingers like this around his legs, and that a friend, a Filipino, who was a prisoner there, fed him when he was too weak to, he was considered dead, and he just gave him spoonfuls at a time until he finally had enough strength. And he also said that a lot of the real strong men just would sit in the corner and will themselves to die. They had no faith or anything.
Right. To the beat, and that's
and
why.
It was his faith that brought him through.
Right. That's why I said the biggest thing was mental, even irregardless of the brutality and disease and so forth. I know we had a uncle and a nephew in our outfit. Pearly Clevenger was perhaps the strongest man in the company. He could lift a 55-gallon drum of gasoline with his two arms. There. When Jim Clevenger died, Pearly lasted about a week because he grieved over his nephew. Yes?
Should we when people cooperated and worked with the Japanese, was that considered disloyal by the other prisoners or any of that?
No, we were all required to work.
I see.
The only exception was in most camps, the officers were limited to camp duties, where the enlisted men had to work on other duty, either in camp or outside, and most of the time they were outside. Such as on the farm there, in Cabana Duan, they had a farm, and we raised camotes, cassava, camotes are sweet potatoes, and mungo beans, which are the same as mung beans, and daigon, which is a type of radish, things of that nature. There. I might tell a little humorous story on which might get some more questions coming out, as we had the guards nicknamed, and some generally on their behavior. We had a Donald Duck and a air raid and a big Speedo, little Speedo, and Charlie Chaplin. Air raid naturally was one of the worst. We had another bad one we called Smiley. Why we called him that? Why he was Smiley was because he would beat the living tar out of you but still have a grin on his face. One of the persons with a fixed expression on it. This Charlie Chaplin was called a Charlie Chaplin because he, like most recruits in the Army, got issued a pair of baggy trousers much larger than he needed. And one of the first times I was out working on the farm, hoeing in the camote patch there, I heard someone singing, trying to sing the first phrase of When the Moon Comes Over the River Colorado. And we were warned not to even speak while we were working, and here somebody was trying to sing. And I looked around, and here was this Japanese guard with the baggy trousers and the rifle and standing there going on over and over on that first phrase. So at Yasume time, which means rest, I asked him if he would like to have the words for the rest of the song. He said he wouldn't. I taught it to him. And later on, very hurriedly so we can have other questions, I happened to be on a mungo bean detail, and that was one of the choice details, and I think some of you might be quick enough to realize why, because you had an opportunity to steal. We were great thieves, I tell you. And we would take straps around our pants legs and pour mungo beans in down our pants legs and get into camp with them. And this particular day, I had a canteen cup of mungo beans in both legs and came up to the gate, and lo and behold, here was a shakedown inspection. So I said to myself, Matson, here's where you get it again, which was common existence in prison camp. So I was sort of getting my feelings up to take the punishment, and here on my side come Charlie Chaplin. And he came up to me and he went up my leg and down the leg, and I know he felt those mungo beans, and never said a word. He passed me on.
Any of the Japs show any compassion towards the prisoners at any time?
All right, I'm very glad you asked that, Alice, because they did. Of course, it varied with the different men, and some of them asked for the punishment. I did in a number of cases, and I'll tell you a case where I did, but to answer your question. There, on board ship, there was a steward. We were unloading. I was in Formosa. And a steward on the ship, we were hauling stuff out of the hole and onto the dock and back and going, just like coolies. We learned the old coolie trot too. And he called me aside and he gave me a hard-boiled egg. Oh, what a treat that was. He was the ugliest nip I ever saw. Must have came from the
Hokkaido, the northernmost island, because he had a very bigger in stature than most Japanese and a big beard. He had a beard similar to mine, except very black there. Next day, he did the same thing. The last day, which we were finishing our work, he asked if I'd like to take a bath. They had on board the Japanese ships, they have these hot tubs, and they didn't have a tub there, but they had a barrel there. And he gave me a towel and a soap, and I bathed myself. I was envy of the other fellows, and again gave me an egg. That's the last I saw that man. Why did he do that? I think only the Lord knows. There have been known of Christians, Japanese, and there. I have a book, and I have a library, which amounts to about 650 books on the prison camp and the Pacific military. I have one in particular my wife has read about the poor man, or the small man of Nantucket in Hong Kong, how he befriended the Japanese. Another incident where I got caught stealing food. I was still a thief in the coal mine. We had broken in or tunneled into a warehouse. Somehow they found out about it, and we got caught coming out. Fortunately, I ate as much as I could before we left, and they beat the living daylights out of us, two of us, Dutch Myers and myself, strung us up on our hands on poles, and then for punishment put us in a cage, and we still had cut our ration, we still had to work. Prior to that, I had worked with a Japanese timberman. He had grandchildren at home, he had sons in the war. When I went to work, I was so hungry, I ate my bento. Bento was Japanese for lunch. We had a little wooden lunch box. I still have mine at home as a memento, one of the little few things I had, and a little pair of chopsticks. And I didn't have any bento, and he asked me why, and I told him I got caught stealing food and I got thrown in the Aso jail. And he smiled and didn't say anything. I think he knew, because word is a small village and word gets around, a mining village. Next day he came to work, he had two bentos. And when it came bento time, he called me down a lateral. And because I was a shotaijo, which was sort of a foreman, I was a spokesman between our American group and the Japanese. I had a little more freedom in the mine than others. And he took off his bento and gave it to me. And for 21 days I was in the jail. He brought me a bento, and his wife would put in a little pickled daigon and a little fish. Of course, they were hurting too. They were in short rations. There. So, yes, there's a lot of them had compassion. I mentioned that sometimes we ask for it, and it happens. One case, and I was pushing, we were late. We'd been working over 12 hours in the mine. We worked two shifts, itchy bang, knee bang, first shift, second shift, 12 hours in the mines. So we were gone from camp all the way from 14 to 16 hours. So you just worked and slept, ate and slept. Then they had a coal drive. I kid my friends, my Navy friends, how come they waited so long to come over and get us? And they retort and said, well, if you didn't dig so much coal for them, the war would have been over a lot sooner. But anyway, this was during the coal drive, and I was pushing a cube coal car out in the tunnel down to the main tunnel where the rock cars were hooked up in a chain and pulled out, and the coal cars were drawn over to a transfer station and dumped on a conveyor belt and out of the mine. We used to sneak out of the mine sometime riding that conveyor belt. Of course, that was illegal too, but to gain a few 15 minutes, 20 minutes sleep, it was worth the risk. Anyway, I was pushing this car out, which held about a cubic meter of coal, which would be about a ton or better in weight. And it hit a rock or something and bounced off the track. And of course, when that happened, then it takes about six prisoners in the condition we were with crowbars, big bars to lift those front wheels back on. And I was down on my hands and knees trying to look at it to see what would be the best way to go at it, because I knew eventually another car would come behind me and they would have to stop and he would have to help me and so forth. And I heard this Japanese start giving me advice, and there again I was mad. So I used a few choice words in English at him, and the next thing I knew I was stretched out, knocked out cold. I came to, I was laid out prawn meat, took a mine pick and creased my skull with a mine pick there, and he was beating on me. So I asked for it, because he understood. When I came to, I saw his red dot on his mine lamp, which means the shotaijo of a superintendent. And naturally, they probably knew English. They did know English. So I told my friends from then on, I switched to the few words of that nature that I couldn't finish. As long as I could smile at the same time, I got away with it. So many times we did that, but nevertheless, I mean, it was a brutal time. Yes, sir.
Much has been made of MacArthur's role in the Philippines, movies, books, various literature, etc. What's your comments with regard to his role in the Philippines?
As MacArthur himself, he was a brilliant strategist, a good general in a military sense. There. Much like other good generals, he was a quite an egotist, thought a lot of himself, similar to George Patton, General Patton. He did have a continual battle in the Pacific between Halsey of the Navy and there. But I think in most cases, MacArthur was right. However, he wasn't too well liked because of those other characteristics. I personally feel, and even in the Korean conflict, if Truman made a bad mistake by not letting MacArthur cross the Yellow River when we had the Japanese running. That's my personal opinion. I think it would have been a free Korea now, but that's not the purpose of this meeting to discuss that.
I mean, we were talking today that I think you heard that I happen to have been on MacArthur's staff. Strategy-wise and planning, you could hardly beat the man, but personally, he was the rottenest individual you could ever work. I mean, I have respect for him and I dislike him. For his job, military planning, his strategy and like that, you couldn't question, but oh boy, his personality was driving him nuts. Did you, I imagine, your men felt the same way?
Ma'am?
It was after the Bataan Death March when General Wainwright was honored in Washington, D.C., and I happened to be there. Now, this is many years ago.
You mean after the end of the war, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And during the war, I was employed as a teacher in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and one of my co-workers' brother-in-law was in the death march, and they were raising money. And so through her, the rest of the staff, and I was a young staff person at that time, I was really, it was my first exposure to such inhumane treatment by other humans through Gladys Wold was her name, an English teacher. and she was very active in the Junior Red Cross. Well, just listening to your talk now, many, many years later, and remembering back to General Wainwright in Washington, D.C., and the monument, and I was there, I wondered, when you said 2,000 were left, during these intervening years, I mean, you were the men who took it, and I don't suppose, General, I don't know anything what happened, but I'm concerned about the military and the big brass of the military and the man on the front line and the support. Now, at one time later, because I happened to be a therapist and I worked in veterans' hospitals, and both my brothers were in war, too, and my dad was in World War I, and the VA hospitals now are criticized because of the lack of treatment and programs. Now, this is many years later, so I have a couple of questions. First, about General Wainwright. Was he involved in any of these reunions? Was it just the men? What was the support of the administration for following you as a veteran up all these years and the other men, the 2,000 men who went through this? Because you hear a lot about the Vietnam vets and how they were neglected.
We didn't have too much there. Of course, personally on Wainwright there, he was still in active service for a while after the war, and then naturally he had his interest with the officer associations and that. As far as I recall, I've been active in most of my years in both the American ex-prisoners of war, which are prisoners from all wars, all theaters. I've held national offices in both organizations, and the American defenders. I don't recall of any occasion when Wainwright came around. I heard he attended some of the lesser functions. I have heard that he was very sympathetic and very warm to any ex-prisoner of war that happened to be in service and be around where he was stationed there. I've heard many stories in that respect. Back to the other part of your question there, when naturally we were that's why we felt orphaned, we let down. In fact, I have a tag, we called ourselves the BB Boys, the Battling Bastards of Bataan, no mama, no papa, no Uncle Sam. And we had, I think, a reason for that, because we did feel orphaned. First of all, we were left there in the start of the war. And I think we were still orphans when we came home, because they had no idea how to take care of us, how to get us back in civilian life and so forth. We started the POW studies San Diego for the Korean, return of the Korean POWs, and for the Vietnam POWs. They asked us for advice, and our doctors gave them what to expect. However, I might say in defense of the VA that things are much better now than they were, but it's unfortunate that many of us fellows had to pass on and die before some of those benefits became known. Right now it is much better, but the ranks are thinning so fast. Out of my outfit, 134 men, there's only 17 of us living today. And 15 of us were in Brainerd a couple weeks ago for our reunion. I'm perhaps in the best shape of any of the fellows, and I thank the Lord for that. I had to take early retirement. This is somewhat of a long story, I won't go into it, but all of us have certain idiosyncrasies and POW syndromes that react. Mine is in my nervous system, and which is affected to my digestive tract, and it affected my teaching. But I was blessed to have a family doctor who saw that, and when the pressures of school came on too hard with me, that I was about ready to go over the deep end, my school nurse realized what was happening, and she took it upon herself to call Dr. Boyd and Eugene. He called me in and he examined me, came out and he said, "Bill, you're retiring." I was only 53. I said, "You're retiring." I said, "What? I can't retire. He said, "Don't worry about it. It's medically feasible. I'll take care of everything." So I've been blessed in so many ways. In fact, the doctor called the superintendent right there and said, "This is Bill's last year. You better find somebody else." Naturally, I got put on disability from school, and most of it, the doctor said, is war-related, so the VA had to come through also. When I got out from under that pressure, then my health returned tremendously, and now my efforts are going in other ways. And as long as I can keep myself from being tied down to a strict schedule, time schedule, and pressure of getting things done, I can operate quite there. And that's why I like the missions where I go to, because many people say, "Well, why don't you sign up for Peace Corps? Why don't you sign up for the organization?" Well, there again, right away I would have a schedule. I would have somebody telling me. I guess I don't like people telling me what to do. I like to operate. My favorite song is Frankie Sinatra, and doing it my way. Yes?
You mentioned about being there when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. What was the reaction of the troops? Did you have any reaction of your captors or any of the other people?
Yes, we saw the mushroom cloud, and the Japanese guards themselves told us that one bomb had wiped out a city, and we told them they were crazy that we had no weapon of that magnitude. We couldn't fathom it in any way, but proved that they were true. Of course, then shortly after it, and I might mention a little bit, I will accept with America part of the responsibility of dropping that first atom bomb on Hiroshima. However, I must say that it saved a lot of lives, even though it took a lot of lives there. Whether it was right or wrong, I'm not saying that, but I know definitely none of us fellows would have survived another winter with just the weather in our condition, let alone the brutality, because the Japanese did overall in China and Formosa and Philippines kill the prisoners when they there rather than liberate. Then that was on the 6th of August. On the 9th of August, the secondary target was Nagasaki. However, immediately after Hiroshima, we sent an ultimatum to Japan asking for their surrender, telling them in no uncertain terms that we will drop another if they do not capitulate. So I think Japan needs to accept some of the responsibility for that. And it does irritate me a little bit on some of these programs that are around the country on the evils, and I agree with that nuclear age has got me scared too. But you gotta, they don't tell all the whole truth. I think the fact should be told that they had the ultimatum and they had the decision or the chance to surrender and did not. Of course, they kept their people stymied also. Then on the 16th, peace negotiations started. We did not know about it. We, all of a sudden, work stopped. I had been working I was working the night shift, that's right, and was going on days. In days, you start work about 3 in the morning, itchy bang. So I went to bed early the night before. My roommate came to me, the same Dutch Meyer that I stole food with, and he said, "There's no work tomorrow." And I said, "Go on, you crazy." He said, "What the heck, you wake me up and tell me that?" Finally dawned on me, I went up, shuffling out and passed one of the guards, sure enough, no work. No reason. Well, at the end. Anyway, I heard the story. He said, there. And he said, no work. We laid around for several days there. Naturally, we thought the invasion was taking place. And then all of a sudden, we laid plans to take over the guard shacks, so we had them all planned that if they looked like they were going to turn the machine gun on us, we're going to try and storm the guards and take them and go up in the mountains. It's mountainous country like we have here. But they called us out and a tinkle bell rang just like here for services. That means, a Japanese colonel came out, unbuckled his sword, handed it over. He says, "Sensei Owari, the war is over." You can imagine we had Dutch, English, American there. We flipped a coin to see whose national anthem we would sing. The English won out, so we all sang lustily, "God Bless the Queen." And then we tried to sing our national anthem, but everybody choked. Thank you.